welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 235 of the podcast. And it is the 19th of September, 2015, as I record this, and the start of the Rugby World Cup. Now, I'm, you know, not a massive rugby fan, but I did live in New Zealand for 7 years. So I will be supporting the All Blacks, even though I am British. So I will be watching some of the matches and may or may not be getting excited over the haka. Anyway, on to today's interview. I'm very excited because I'm talking to Liliana Hart today, who is one of the indie authors I most respect and admire, both as a creative, an author, and as a businesswoman. She's one of my role models as the CEO of a global publishing business, as well as an excellent author of mysteries and romantic suspense. And I've met Liliana twice now at London Book Fair in 2014, I think it was last year, or it might even been the year before, which was kind of a game-changing time for me to meet her, Bella Andre, Jacinda Wilder, Barbara Freethy, you know, the romance ladies, as we like to say, who really are sort of leading the way in the indie movement. Also, then I saw Liliana at Thriller Fest earlier this year with her husband, Scott, and again, it was fantastic to see her kind of take on the traditionally published authors in their own game, which was wonderful. And today I talked to Liliana about exclusivity. She is also fundamentally against exclusivity, and she makes more money from iBooks than she does from Amazon. And she gives some suggestions as on how to sell on these other platforms, plus why a long-term business plan is important as an author. We also touch on why print may be the next big thing for indies rather than translations, which I think is a bit of a turn up for the books, really. Pun intended. So in publishing news this week, there have been a couple of things. First of all, the latest author earnings report, which is always brilliant, at authorearnings.com. And one thing that I find interesting, and I keep telling my compatriots in traditional publishing, indie books without ISBNs have grown from 30% of all Kindle ebooks to 37% of all Kindle ebooks being purchased in September. So 37% of all Kindle ebooks purchased in September do not have ISBNs, and mine are one of them, or many of them. I do not use ISBNs on my ebooks, and I use free create-based ones. I know this is one of these issues that comes up for indies, and actually, it's one of the few issues that I disagree with Orna Ross, my friend from the Alliance of Independent Authors. Orna is, recommends buying and using ISBNs. And I'm almost making a point about it now. But I still see no evidence that using an ISBN actually makes you more money. If they were free, I would use them. So there's a little shout out to Nielsen. If they were free, like they are in Canada, I would use them. But I think it's interesting. So if 37% of all Kindle ebooks in September don't have ISBNs, then that's just, that none of those are being counted in any of the reports, which suggests that sales are flat. Actually, what's happening is indies are stealing market share. So, and then it says, when indie ebooks that do have ISBNs are included, indie self-published books now make up 42% of all Kindle ebooks being purchased on Amazon right now. So that's really interesting. And then if they then mash together all indie books, all Amazon publishing books, all kind of non-traditionally published ebooks make up 58% of all Kindle ebooks. So traditionally published ebooks now make up 42% purchased in the US. So this is really fascinating, and the graphs are well worth having a look at. It's quite a dense article. It needs to be because of the scrutiny that author earnings gets, but really interesting stuff and not very surprising. So I have a friend who's got a book out this week, and I was really kind of upset to see that his Kindle book, because, you know, now publishers are putting their own prices back on books again, his Kindle book will be sold for £9.99, which is around $14.99 US. And I just said to him, that's just not going to sell. You know, he's not a household name. He's not somebody that people are necessarily going to line up to buy. And I think his print book was like half that price. So it's crazy. I mean, this is why, this really is why. So yeah, so the message, I guess, from the latest author earnings report is don't listen to the industry reports that show declining sales, because they only measure books with ISBNs. And secondly, keep on trucking, keep writing, keep publishing, be indie and proud, or go indie if you haven't yet, or at least make it part of your portfolio, because you want to be part of this growing market share. The second thing that sort of was out this week that caused a bit of a stir, and there's still more and more articles coming out on either side of this, it's one of those author articles that I just, it is unnecessary really, because, you know, authors should stick together. But one writer on Huffington Post basically said, self-publishers do not put out 4 books a year. And if you haven't seen this article, it's worth reading, and you know, read some of the rebuttals to it, because it's an interesting sort of, it's the quality versus time argument again. But I've particularly enjoyed some of the witty articles rebuffing the writer. You know, I can now say, because I am now 2 weeks into my 11th fiction book, it could be 12th if you include the short story collection, I can definitely say that the faster I write, the less attention I pay to critical voice, and the more my writing flows, and amazingly, substantially, I need to edit less when I write in flow. And we all need to find our own speed, and it has taken me this long. I think it was book 9 when this kind of first started happening. And so now I trust the process a lot more. But if you want to make a living from books, you need product. So what's so interesting is the article realistically is from an author who doesn't make a living with books or with her writing. So my advice with this is, as always, listen to people who are actually making a living in the way that you want to make a living. And always look behind the story at what others are doing to understand their angle on the process. So I think this is so important, and I've talked about this before, but you know, in today's, I listen to someone like Liliana Hart, who you will hear the interview coming up very, very soon. I listen to Liliana because she makes money in the way that I want to. I'm not going to write romance books like she does, but, you know, I want to make money with my books. I want to make money teaching other people how to do this. And this is basically what I am doing. So I think it's very, very important, whenever you read an article, just dig a bit more in. If you read an article and you think, okay, yeah, that makes sense, just, or it touches you in some way, have a look at who that person is and what their story is. You know, I try and be very transparent about how I make my money, reporting recently on my six-figure income earnings, in order to be transparent, and I'm going to keep doing that. So yeah, I think it's very important to understand what skin people have in the game. Right, on personal stuff, we have now finished week 2 of co-writing our working title, Risen Gods, me and Jay Thorne. We are 30,000 words in, which is really, really cool. And it's probably the most addictive thing about co-writing is that the first draft word count is swiftly very impressive. So if I was doing it on my own, I probably would be around 12,000 words. But because two things. One, obviously, we've both been writing every day, 5 days a week. So we've done 10 days altogether. So averaging 3,000 words a day between two of us, which actually is not massive. So averaging 1,500 words each, which is, you know, I'm not a fast writer, so it's about 2 hours for me to do that. But I'm really, 30,000 words, we're kind of, you know, almost halfway, which is amazing. And I'm also enjoying the accountability of knowing that when I get up in the morning, I need to do my word count, because Jay is going to wake up in 5 hours' time after me, because he's in the US, and he will do his writing. So every day I feel the accountability of having somebody else there who I I have to report back to and say, yes, I've done my words. You know, we do like a tag thing. So that's cool. I'm also continuing to deep dive into Maori mythology and also volcanology. And I want to give a big thanks to listeners, Aaron Compton from New Zealand, who will be beta reading to check we're being culturally sensitive. Thank you, Aaron. And also to Jonathan Byron, who has a PhD in geography and will be beta reading from the volcanology side. And Jonathan lived in Iceland for 5 years. So thank you to you guys. And this is why I love the community, because you never know who is listening. And I really appreciate getting emails that say, you know, can I help you with this book? And I'm really super pleased about that, because, you know, I love New Zealand. I absolutely want to be culturally sensitive, but you know, myth is not copyrighted, so you know, you can write stories with all the myths you like, basically. But yeah, thank you everyone for tuning in and for your generosity. Okay, what else? Last call for the Scrivener webinar with the wonderful Scrivener coach, Joseph Michael. These are super popular webinars that we've done twice before, and really enjoy that. I get something new out of them every time. So whether you're a beginner or an advanced Scrivener user, you will find this useful. You can join us on Thursday, 24th of September at 3 p.m. US Eastern or 8 p.m. London, or if you register, you can get the recording, and there will be lots of tips on how to effectively use Scrivener to organize, write, publish, etc. So you can register at thecreativepen.com/love Scrivener, thecreativepen.com/love Scrivener, or check out the show notes. Right, so here is what you've sent me this week. Jennifer Aramiva, amusing, or not very amusingly, sent a picture of her burnt leg and said, listened while you talked volcanoes while redressing a lava burn that I got in Iceland. Yes, really. So get well soon, Jennifer. I'm so sorry about that. But I hope you had a good time in Iceland. It's somewhere I haven't been yet, but I definitely want to go. Sonia Helbig says, fantastic podcast on descriptions, was driving but must now re-listen on fast forward so that I can implement. Nathan Russell, interesting, says, listen to the latest episode, amazed your course near Glasgow had so many people unaware of print on demand, Scrivener, etc. This is a really good point, Nathan. And what I want to just remind everyone, and I really feel this whenever I teach, is we all know so much more than we think. It's like, we've all come so far. It doesn't matter at what stage you are. There are always people who do not know about print on demand. There are always people who do not realize the opportunities you have as an indie author. There are always people who've never heard of KDP, who just don't understand this new world. So I would say there that always, I mean, what I like to do is always try and spread the word about these things, obviously, but, you know, keep talking to people that until this is mainstream, and it's not yet, it might feel like it is because we exist in our little echo chamber. But if you just step out of the echo chamber, you realise that people just don't have a clue. So thank you for that, Nathan. Anthony St. Clair says, listening to the podcast while tallying votes for what my fourth book title should be. My choice didn't win out. Yeah, so Anthony did an interesting thing on Facebook. He put four different titles for a fantasy book and took votes on what people liked. I actually think that's probably going to be more effective to do to your target audience. So I joined in, but I don't read fantasy books. So I'm not surprised my choice didn't win out. Claire Lydon sent a very nice picture of a swimming pool in the sun and says, listening to your podcast while relaxing by my friend's pool in Almeria, Spain. Very nice. MG Camacho says, the How to Write Your Sales Description with Brian Cohen has been my favourite episode, as I can definitely relate and need to improve on mine. Yes, we all do. I must say, as we were talking, I was like, yeah, I really need to improve some of my stuff too. Brandon Cullen says, listening to your podcast while making fun videos for my book launch and sent a picture. Well, it's actually a cool GIF, you know, one of those moving pictures of a dinosaur cartoon, which looked awesome. Sarah Thompson, love this week's podcast. I'm a copywriter, but generally work in businesses. Found Brian's info great for book copy. Monica Rodriguez, listened to last week's episode while packing for a trip, sent a picture of a suitcase, which made me want to go traveling. Emily says, I got the Monday blues, so listening to the podcast to motivate me. Morning, Emma, or afternoon, and I hope you will be motivated by Liliana today. I pretty much think you will be. Sarah Beth says, loved your interview with Brian, about to publish my first novel, so perfect timing for me. Great. And social media author, which is a great handle, said, a great interview with Mark Coker, and I enjoy your episodes while working out at the gym. I love that the episodes are longer than just 30 minutes. You pack a lot of info into them and I love them. Thank you so much for that feedback. I appreciate that, because some days I feel like, oh, I'm going on a bit long. Like, this is a long intro today. I realise that and I haven't finished yet. So I'm glad you enjoy that. I also like longer podcasts where you can get more into depth with people. So thank you for that. Okay, so what are you doing while listening to the show, or has a particular podcast spurred you into action? Please do tweet me at The Creative Pen. Send me a picture of what you're doing while listening to the show, or any other picture from where you live in the world. As a travel junkie, I love to see it. Or email me, joanna@thecreativepen.com, and let me know. Right, this podcast episode is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and I'm actually going to do the ad today, and we are really in a sort of anti-exclusivity mode on this show, because I've just had my biggest monthly author payout ever, and it's been mostly from Kobo, not Amazon. So that is very cool, and that was down to a promotion that happened a couple of months ago, and very happy about that. I love having my income split across multiple stores. It makes me feel much more secure in a long-term global sales market. And you have probably heard me mention before that I have now sold books in 68 countries through Kobo, and that is in English. This is a really important point. These book sales are in English, not in translation. So you can definitely do this too. And people often ask me, how do you market to those countries? And the truth is, I don't. Kobo does. So people find the app and read digitally. And of course, most of these sales are negligible in the big scheme of things. And the bulk of my income through Kobo is from Canada, USA, Australia, New Zealand, and the UK. But what is exciting about it is those little trickles add up over time. I actually do want to start doing a report on the sales of US, UK versus rest of world. We'll hopefully do that in the next 6 months. Now my husband's joined the business and he's better at data than me. But still, it's very, very cool. And also remember that any marketing you do online, blogging, podcasting, social media, it's all available globally for people to find. So you'll be wanting to know how to get noticed on Kobo Writing Life, because like Nook, like iBooks, it is based around merchandising. So a few tips that are relevant on Kobo and also on other stores outside of Amazon or So first of all, series books are more likely to be merchandised. So yes, write a series, yes, have great covers, and have a free first in series, as the sell-through often makes it worth promoting. And Kobo has a special page for free first in series. Higher prices are also good and advised, because again, when a store like Kobo makes money from merchandising, everybody needs to make money. Therefore, if your book is priced higher, then it's more likely to get merchandised. So my box sets sell well at Kobo. They are actually my highest earners at Kobo. So I even have a writer's toolbox that is not on Amazon. I actually have a product that I don't sell on Amazon that is on Kobo and on iBooks and Nook, as I sell it for over $9.99. Now that is a great example of a product that you can create and that is then able to be merchandised at a discount. Remember to put links on your websites to Kobo and the other stores. So many authors just promote Amazon, so why is it a surprise when you get no love back? And also get to know the people at Kobo Writing Life at conventions, or comment on their podcast or the blog at kobowritinglife.com. And if you publish directly through Kobo Writing Life, there will be opportunities to participate in various promotions. Plus, you can also publish through Smashwords or Draft2Digital to get onto the store that way. And yes, I'm sure some of you, and I've had people tell me, oh, well, of course, Kobo sell your books because Kobo sponsor your podcast. But it actually is round the other way, because I published on Kobo Writing Life before they became a sponsor, before I got to know anybody at Kobo, and I developed relationships over time, promoted their store, and then eventually the the sponsorship for the podcast came along. So I don't, you know, I want people to realize how these things work over time. And it is over time. I mean, seriously, I've been publishing on, you know, since 2008 on Amazon. I got onto Kobo as soon as it came out. You know, I've had my biggest month ever a couple of, you know, good few, what, 4 years later. So it does take time, but that's what the game we're in. We are in the long-term game. Okay. I should say, check out kobo.com/writing life to get started. Okay, so that was a little bit extra. So this corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. A big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. Thanks especially to new patron, Vanessa Rydell. And thanks to all those people who've upped their pledge since I moved to a weekly show. I really appreciate the Patreon support, like the tweets and emails. It really demonstrates that you enjoy the show and want it to continue. On Patreon, if you're interested, check out patreon.com/thecreativepen. That's patreon.com/thecreativepen. Right, we should get on with the interview. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm here with Liliana Hart. Hi Liliana.
Hello, how are you?
Oh, I'm good. It's so good to have you on the show. But just a little introduction for anyone who doesn't know you. Liliana is a New York Times, USA Today and Publishers Weekly best-selling romantic suspense and mystery author of over 40 books. She's also an entrepreneur running the Silver Heart Author Resources site with her husband, Chief of Police Scott Silveri, which is just brilliant. And so Liliana, look, you know, you're a mega star indie. You've sold over 3 million books, you've made all these bestseller lists, and you're incredibly successful. But it wasn't always this way, was it? So
no.
Maybe you could just take us a step back, tell us how you got into writing, self-publishing, you know, so back where a lot of people listening are today.
Yeah, a lot of I hear that a lot, like overnight success, and I'm like, well, you know, I've been writing for 17 years and only the last four of them have been successful. So, my history, you know, I started writing. I actually completed, several novels. You know, I landed an agent actually after my first novel, I landed my first agent. And, I have the, well, knock on wood, but I have the, you know, don't have all the best agent luck. So my first agent, you know, books went out on submission. And then almost immediately pulled because she had to close her agency because her husband got sick with cancer. So, you know, those books came back in. And then second agent, I've written another book. Sorry, my eyes water, and I don't know why. And then she got pregnant, went on maternity leave, and she decided not to come back. And then my third agent, you know, and I had more books by that time. And actually, it was my third agent. That was right at 2010. And, you know, in 2010... you know, just publishing was just in the toilet. Nobody was buying anything. There was a freeze on everything. And she was really the one that mentioned to me, you know, why don't you self-publish? And, you know, she was a good agent and she had a lot of huge authors. And so I started self-publishing, you know, during her time, and actually, ended up, you know, parting ways on good terms. But, it was just, I kept saying something big is about to happen. I can feel it. You know, it's, you know, things are about to happen. And so I left, and actually it was a week later that I hit the New York Times list for the first time. And then, you know, I'm still with my current agent. I've been with him a couple of years, but you know, it has not been a, you know, just overnight
success.
You know, it's been a lot of hard work and a lot of hours and a lot of books written, a lot of words on the page, and, a lot of wanting to quit, but not quitting, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, the first, you know, like I said, you know, 17 years, that's a long time. And the first 13 of those were rejection after, I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of rejection. I actually had four different books. Addison Holmes was one of them. J.J. Graves was one of those first books. And, they were actually acquired by editors from different houses. And, you know, we want to buy this book. And then when it got to marketing said, we can't shelve this anywhere. We can't shelve it in mystery. We can't shelve it in romance. It's too much of both. You know, And so, you know, that happened four times to me, like a book acquired that an editor loved it. And then it got to marketing and then it got shot down, you know? And so I was, you know, about the fourth time that happened, I was like, okay, I can't, you know, you just get to that point where you're like, I can't take it anymore. You know, when is this going to happen? And, it turned out that having that kind of cross genre appeal, is really what helped with self-publishing, I think, because readers don't like to be told that, you know, they can only have this in mystery and only this in romance. You know, they like the cross genre appeal.
Mm. And so are you kind of, so what do you use an agent for now? Cause you self-publish all your books yourself, right now.
Yeah. Right now he does, all foreign stuff for me, just with traditional publishers, and he does, you know, any film, things like that. And I do, you know, I do get offers from, big houses occasionally. So, you know, he filters all that and comes to me with whatever information he has to come with. So
I think it's really important for people to know how long your journey is, but also then it kind of everything took off for you. We're going to come back to that in a minute. But, you know, at Thriller Fest, we met earlier this year at Thriller Fest, and you mentioned that you are against exclusivity. And one of the things that many people are doing right now, of course, is pulling off going back to KDP Select. They, you know, taking over the world. And many people think you can only make money in KDP Select. So, why are you so into non-exclusivity?
Well, I think first of all, because this is not a flash in the pan career. It is not, it is for some people, it's a hobby and, you know, they're looking to make that quick money. But if anybody that's looking at this, I mean, you know, I spent that long going through rejection after rejection, you know, and those are the people that are looking for careers. And, you know, I'm not looking at tomorrow. I'm looking 5 years from now and 10 years from now and where the market's going to be, where I'm going to be, where publishing is going to be. And for anyone to think that 10 years from now that Amazon is going to be the only game in town, I think is, I don't want to say the word foolish, but I think it is foolish. You know, I think from a business sense, it is. It's not having a broad scope of the spectrum. Because it is a business. I am a publisher. I run a publishing house, and anybody that self-publishes, that's what you do. It's a business, and people need to treat it that way. And, you know, one of the things I kind of did for my, you know, the workshop I'm doing this weekend, you know, when I started in, you know, 2011 is really when self-publishing started taking off. It was a, you know, it was still very looked down upon. It was almost like this, everybody was kind of sneaking into it, you know, because nobody wanted to admit they were doing it. And then, you know, but we were seeing immediate results, you know. So, you know, it was kind of like this, is this really happening? Is this really real? And then 2012 came along and it's like, oh my gosh, you know, what's, you know, this can't last forever. And it's almost like play money, you know. Mm-hmm. And you keep working and you keep doing and it's exciting and you put more books out because you can, you know, for somebody that didn't make money for 13 years while they were writing and all of a sudden you're seeing all this money, the more you do, the more money you make. Mm. And then it gets to be almost like a game. It is. It's like Monopoly money. And then, you know, 2013 hit and, you know, you're like, I think 2013 was like the golden year, you know. Mm. It was a good year for, you know, really everyone, I think. You know, it was still easy to be visible. Amazon hadn't figured out how to manipulate the algorithms all together. You know, publishers hadn't gotten enough information to, you know, kind of put dampers on everything. So it was like a free-for-all 2013 was, you know. You know, we were speaking for the first time at, you know, big book fairs, you know, with London and BEA and Frankfurt and, you know, it's just, so it was really a power year, I think, because that's when, you know, publishers started adopting self-publishing models and using the same tools that we're using, the same pricing structure and the same sales and the same freebies. And they started adjusting with all of that and really copying the self-publishing model. Actually, I've gotten emails from Big Five publishers before asking, you know, how I did something a certain way. And you know,
could they pay you to consult?
No, but they don't mind sending the emails to ask. But, you know, so it's, so 2014 hit, and I think that I call 2014 like the year that like the wheat's kind of separated from the chaff, because at that point it's a job, it's a business. The fun and games and Monopoly money are over. It's who can sustain at that point, because that's when, you know, the real hurdles started happening. You know, KU rolled out in July and of 2014, you know, and starting in January 2014, publishers, you know, came out hitting hard and heavy. You know, there were a lot of blog posts from, you know, CEOs and of the publishing houses, you know, with all these, their stats, about how ebooks were in decline, and there was a 35% decline in the ebook market, which, yeah, their market is in a decline, but, you know, none of those stats included self-publishing ebooks. You know, so it was a lot of fear and scare tactics, and then, you know, as the year went on, and then KU rolled out, and I think that is a lot of it is, you know, with the exclusivity, it is fear that drives that, because it was, to be quite honest, it was easy to make money those first 3 years. And, you know, people are quitting their day jobs, and they're, you know, they're not making the wisest, they're not thinking like a business, you know, they're not ready to, it was just play at that point. And so that's when you really see, I think, 2014, it roll out, who's going to be able to sustain. But I think anybody that is looking to be here in 10 and 20 years and still continue to do this is not going to be able to do exclusive. And I know that there are, you know, like, you know, Hugh is one of my dearest friends, and we will argue about this till the day that we die, you know, but because he's all on the exclusivity train. But to him, you know, I mean, he's about to
sail on his boat.
He's about to sail on his boat, you know. It's like, to him, it's not, you know, he just wants to write, and it's not, he doesn't look at it the same way I think a lot of us do, is that career, you know, it's pleasing one, you know, one day at a time kind of thing, instead of a really goal-oriented, futuristic look on how to sustain for the long haul. And I think that's really important to realize, is that, you know, I think the biggest issue with KU, in my opinion, is that it's teaching readers to devalue books. You know, aside from the exclusivity, you know, I was one of the authors that was offered the opportunity to be in KU right when it rolled out for 6 months without having to be exclusive. And I did it. And then, and I actually pulled out of it early, because I didn't, even with the extra all-star bonuses and stuff like that I was getting, I still was not, there was nothing, no way would I have made up the money that I make from other retailers. I've never actually gotten negative emails or comments about my pricing ever. And I charge, you know, up to $4.99, $5.99 and up for my books, and always have. And I've never had complaints from readers about my pricing. And the first emails that I got after I pulled out were, well, you have a new book out, but I'm used to getting it for free.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're like, I'm not going to pay $4.99 for a book. And I'm like, well, you know,
then you're not reading my books.
You're not going to read my books. you know, I think you're going to see similar to what happened in the music business. But just from a business standpoint, when you're going exclusive like that, you know, I sell three times in iBooks what I do at Amazon. And iBooks is huge. They have a billion, you know, Apple has a billion devices. And, you know, and KU has 700,000 books to be offered in their, you know, in their program. But when you're looking at the competition, you know, as far as like the stats of rising, like who has come the furthest in the 5 years, iBooks charts, they have progressed much faster than any other retailer as far as, you know, what they've done in book sales and stuff like that. And I think that, I think to put all your eggs in Amazon's basket is a mistake.
Well, let's just talk a bit more about iBooks, because when you said that at Thrillerfest, there was like an audible gasp in the room. and people were like, how can you make more money in iBooks than Amazon? So maybe could you talk about like what are some things people can do, or what did you do to actually move the needle at iBooks, which, let's face it, doesn't have an algorithm in the same way that Amazon does?
Oh, and I can't explain, you know, the reason that I like iBooks is because they, of all the retailers, all the big, you know, the five retailers, and I'm including like Google Play and you know, Kobo, Barnes & Noble, Amazon into that. The reason I like iBooks is because when you go to their store, that is the truest sense of what readers want to read. You're right. They don't have algorithms that you can't buy spots. You can't buy the number one spot in the store. You can't buy paid advertising. The book that is number one in the store is number one in the store because the readers put it there. And so you can really get a sense of the true, a true top 100, a true, you know, in each category. And, you know, the readers are a little different. Free books work extremely well, at iBooks. And actually they're, you know, the percentage of downloads of free books increased by 39% last year. And, you know, and it's not free book hoarding like you see at Amazon. You know, you see them go through and then you don't see the sell through in your next books in the series. And I actually had a book, the first book in a series of J.J. Graves' Dirty Little Secrets. It was an editorial pick for Book of the Week, which means I had to make it free for the entire week. And then the editorial team would promote it through the site. And that book was downloaded, you know, at iBooks at the time, and this was a couple years ago, so 60,000 downloads in a week was incredible. But within 3 days, I saw the rise of the next books in the series. So people were reading the book immediately and then buying. All of those books are still in the top 100.
Really?
Wow. That one promotion. And the sustainability at iBooks is, you know, you're not going to see those crazy jumps and ranking and ranking is skewed at Amazon now anyway because it's prioritized to KU and KDP Select. And, you know, that's, I think that's hard for authors to see because, you know, I've been number five, number six in the Amazon store. For sales, and I'm selling the same number of books, but my rankings are way lower, you know. And I think, you know, I think everything is purposely done. Amazon is a business; they're not stupid. They're a corporation; they know exactly what they're doing. And I love the people at Amazon; I talk to them all the time, you know. But at the same time, you know, they're running a business, and I'm running a business, and they're going to do what's best for their business. Let's face it; you know, they can. Yeah, if that fear is in there, that's what authors are going to be like. Well, I got to make money now. I've quit my job. I've done all this stuff, and I've got to make money now. But in 10 years from now, when you've alienated a huge percentage of your readership, and you know, that's hard to get back. You know.
Yes, so I guess there we've got, we talked there about kind of having a free first in series that is really important and writing a series, which I think everybody knows now. But do you drive traffic differently for iBooks than you do for Amazon? So do you do specific Facebook ads to iBooks, for example?
Yes, I do. I do. I'll drive them directly to iBooks. I'll drive them directly to Amazon. And I'll run them at different times, you know, to do test, I guess, test ads and stuff like that. But I'll tweet directly to iBooks, you know, and they recommend that when you promote your book, don't promote a glut of links for every store, you know, divide them up and then they'll retweet you once you start doing that. But yeah, I found free books work especially well, and also pre-orders. A great way to gain a foothold at Amazon or at Apple is with pre-orders, and they are the only ones that will let you put in an asset-less pre-order, which means you do not have to have a finished book. You do not have to have any part of the book.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to have a cover. You don't have to have anything, and you can put it up for pre-order a year in advance. And, that's huge, as far as sales and, you know, just getting the word out and also drawing attention to yourself from them. because if they see that a book is getting good pre-order numbers and you've got that long, they're going to do something about it. It also gives the marketing and merchandising team, you know, something to do about it. I actually talked to someone last week and they're like, well, I let iBooks know that I had a new release come out and it was like 2 days away from the release. Mm. Well, I mean, we're in September right now and I have a February release and we're already talking about marketing and merchandising for my February release. Right. So you've got to give them plenty of time to do stuff for you. You know, you can't just send them an email and be like, hey, do this stuff for me. You know, yeah, I mean, it's Monday. A well-oiled machine. Yeah.
Yeah.
They really do. I mean, there's a team involved and they, you know, they sit down and have meetings and they talk about the books because, and I think, you know, they are very much in the book business. You know, they're going to promote and sell books. And actually at iBooks, my romances don't sell at iBooks. I mean, they sell, but not, you know, but my mysteries are the ones that sell at iBooks. It's a different kind of reader. They don't mind paying a higher price. Mm. You know, they have no issues with, you know, free books work well, but cheap books do not work well at iBooks. Mm. So price high. And, but those pre-orders are amazing. And they also don't count against your rank, like at Amazon. So you can actually be in the top 100 as a pre-order. And then when the book drops, you'll still get the rank of all the pre-orders for that day. So, you know, it's pre-orders help sell books a lot along with the freebie. I'm trying to think what else I'm missing.
Well, I think from what you've said, you almost have to completely change your mindset around iBooks compared to the way that people have been doing things at Kindle. And like you said, you need a production schedule. And you need to know when the release is coming so you can actually organize that. And let's face it, most indies don't do that.
Yeah. I know my production schedule at least a year in advance.
And that's an advanced thing, I think. But, you know.
I mean, that's a business. Yeah, it's a business thing. Mm. You know, and I can't, you know, I can't stress that enough. You know, it's a business. It's a publishing house. What publishing house doesn't know what books they don't have that are cannot coming out a year from now, you know, or two years from now? They're already, you know, they're already shelving for 2017. I have a schedule and a board, and you know, I'm scheduled through next December. I know exactly what's coming out, when it's coming out, and what I have to write, the amount of words I have to write, and what books, you know. Mm. And
hope you've put some holidays in there.
I am getting better at that. I am getting better.
Okay, so one other thing on iBooks is that they've recently changed, because obviously there's been iBooks and iTunes kind of completely separate for years. They've now kind of slightly more integrated it, so you could, from iBooks, you can see the audiobooks. How are the audiobook sales going on iTunes? You know, given that most people are now kind of going with ACX exclusive deals and stuff, how do you feel the audiobook market is shifting? And, you know, what is your advice around audiobooks with iTunes specifically?
Well, I was actually just looking at the audiobooks became, or, you know, at Audible, it actually became a $1 billion industry last year for the first time. It is a huge, increase in a percentage of market sales. You know, just with audiobooks, if you're not in already audiobooks, you should be in audiobooks, but that's my caveat is with ACX, I was fortunate enough to be in on that original contract that was the 50 to 90% graduated royalty rate. And now it's the 40% flat. And when they changed that, I actually scheduled my next 5 or 6 audiobooks so I could get under that contract. I have not signed a new audio contract with them since the 40%, and I probably will not at this point because... you know, just doing the math, you know, I can't see the point of paying up front, you know, a couple $1,000s for my production of my audiobook and then only retaining 40% of the royalties. Mm-hmm. So, and I've never been a fan of the 50-50 split. I don't think that that's, you know, just splitting your royalties with anyone is a bad, you know, business move. 'Cause, you know, 6 years from now, if you become, you know, the next Twilight or whatever. And, you know, I mean that it did what it took Twilight 6 years to be a hit, you know, it was out 6 years before, it, you know, stuff like that happens all the time. These sleeper books that gain word of mouth and slow moving like that. I mean, what's, you never want to be in a fix where you're the that sleeper hit, and then all of a sudden you're having to give 50% of your royalties away to somebody that didn't write the book.
I love how you think that big. That kind of big is great.
Yeah.
but back on actually selling audiobooks, do you have any tips for kind of people to market on iBooks specifically?
On iBooks specifically, it's still it's a slower market for iBooks. I am seeing the increase, but I actually have on my website an audio page, and there's SoundClouds on there of every one of my audiobooks. People can go through and listen to samples, and then they can purchase, like, the iBooks link is right beneath it. They can click on that and go directly to the store to buy the audiobook. But I found that increased my audio sales a lot, just having that accessibility on my website and the samples right there. And I promote them just on social media. I'll be like, I'll put all four covers of the audio, and they do have so many giveaways that you can do for, audiobooks and also for your, your regular ebooks, download codes and stuff like that you can do giveaways with. And I always I'll give away like 5 first copies, and then
we should just stress that a bit more. So iBooks have it's unlimited codes, isn't it, that you can is it 50? I think it might be 50.
It could be 50. I was gonna say, my first instinct was to say it was 250.
Oh, okay. Well, it's quite a lot anyway, so you can get free codes to give away for iBooks. Yeah,
Scott tells me it is 250.
Oh, there we go. Wow, that's loads. So you can give that many away. And how important do you think reviews are on iBooks? Because you kind of get the sense that Amazon now reviews count for algorithm juice. But, what does it matter on iBooks?
It matters that people look at the star percentage rating. You don't have to leave a review to star it, which I've always thought is nice. And people at iBooks review, like the readers that, because at the end of your book, that star comes up and you can star it. Mm. I think just like anything, if they're like I always look for 4 stars of it, just as a reader. Mm. I think probably too, and they have the statistics to tell you, iBooks readers are, they are career driven people. They're busy people. They're people that read on the train, on the, while they're traveling, while commuting, things like that. They want efficiency. So they're going to do things like that. Just look at the star rating and make a quick purchase, download and go. Mm. I think it's a different type of reader for sure.
And what do you think about, like, for example, the foreign, because most people's sales are still big in the US and UK, Canada, but the biggest phone in China is the iPhone, for example. I mean, what do you see as like the, and of course, Germany, people are seeing the sales. What do you see as the global expansion of digital?
Well, I was going to say a year ago, 2013, that golden year when there were no obstacles, and then the beginning of 2014, that was a big thing for all of us that had been in it a while, was the global market, translations, all these things. And then the VAT tax came along. Mm. And I think that's been, that's hurt authors, it's hurt readers. And so I think there's been a huge slowdown in the global market. One of our biggest things was, 2 years ago was to get started on translations. Now it's kind of a waste of money right now, because the global market cannot sustain what you're having to spend on translations.
Yeah, I agree in translation, but in English, I'm seeing sales in lots
and
more countries.
Germany is always huge for English sales. And I'm seeing a huge uptick of English sales in France also. Really, I'm not seeing a huge, it's pretty much stayed the same. I do think the VAT tax has hurt everyone.
Damn the EU.
it's either we as authors raise our prices to equal it out, and then the reader, has to pay more, or we eat it and we lose money and to keep the cost down for the reader. So it's a, it's not a good situation for anyone, but I think it's for sure slowed the global market. I think, you know, my wisest advice there, especially everybody that's kind of entrenched with, you know, with translations and stuff like that, is to slow down. There's no hurry now, because there's not a market to sustain it right now.
It's
a huge expense.
I've stopped doing them as well. It's just like it's just no. Even Spanish in the American market, you'd think Spanish ebooks would be selling, but
Spanish has never been big. And I always tell people, they're like, I'm going to get them done in Spanish. I'm like, don't do Spanish. Spanish is probably your fifth language you need to do. German is one, and then you've got French, you've got Italian, you've got Brazilian Portuguese, and then Spanish. It's not a big selling language for books. So the translations.
So then what else do you see? Because like you said, people should be looking ahead, thinking of this as a longer term career. What else do you think is coming? What should people be doing to kind of position themselves?
Well, I think, I think Barbara Freedy started it, you know, when she made the deal with Ingram. I think you're going to start seeing a lot more indies come out in print. And then the deal that, Create Space and Jamie McGuire did with Walmart. I think you're going to see a lot more of that kind of thing. And I think it's going to kind of upend things for a little bit, because that's really been, that's the argument I've been hearing from publishers for the last year or so, you know, when they'll come to me with offers and stuff like that. It's like, you know, we are your avenue for print. And now that's no longer the case. So I think you're going to, you know, see a shift there, and they're going to have to rethink things. And it's going to be interesting for print, because I think especially indies that are selling a lot, they're looking for print. They're looking to get that next corner of the market, a different avenue of readers. So I think that's going to be a biggie. I think audiobooks right now, they're probably the safest thing to do. I would probably sell the rights to my next audiobooks instead of going just to
ACX.
Just because of the percentage, I'm just not happy with the contract now. And that's something, I think is really important, with translations too. I've had the biggest headache with translations, and that's something that, Bella Andre, she's talked about several times. She went with one company for translations. It was a disaster. She was out thousands and thousands of dollars. So we all got together and we're like, okay, we're going to try this company. And I guess I was the test dummy for that one, because I went all in and, had, a lot of translations done. Total would it ended up being something, it's a couple hundred thousand dollar investment to do translations. And well, here I am a year later and I don't have any translations, but I'm out $100,000+. And, it's just finding companies, that are reliable. And what are you going to do? I'm in the US. They're not, you're looking at legal battles. You're looking at, look at your contracts. This is where, having an attorney look at your contracts and stuff like that. Is handy and not, that's something, thinking like a business, there are things that you're good at and things you're not going to be good at. Learn what to farm out and what to, what your expertise
is. Yeah. And then, of course, you're taking your business. I mean, you're CEO of the, multi-million dollar company, and now you and Scott have started Silver Heart.
Yeah.
So tell us about that and what the plan is with that.
Yeah, well, we basically just decided that we need to be able to combine what we do, and because otherwise we'd never see each other or could spend time together. But it's I write mystery, I write romantic suspense, and he's been in law enforcement for 26 years, and he actually just retired last week.
Congratulations!
He's got like a retirement beard and everything. He's going all crazy. But we just combined those two things, self-publishing and writing, and then law enforcement. And so it's a site designed really as a resource for writers. So, very rarely do you come across a book that doesn't have some kind of cop or firefighter or, you know, some kind of public safety, you know, reading these articles or, you know, I mean, just about ridiculous stuff, you know, research is like the bane of your existence.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's fun. I love research, but I'll spend 3 days looking like at one knife or something like that. And instead of writing, you know, 10,000 words or something. But, you know, we have all those resources on the site. So, you know, if you need to talk to a Navy SEAL, if you need to talk to a cop, if you need to talk to a firefighter or a medical examiner, a paramedic, or, you know, if you need to talk to an inspector from London, a Canadian, or, you know, we've got somebody from South Africa, you know, just different perspectives from all over the world of public safety. And if you have a question or need to know a procedure or how something works, you can go in and you can talk directly to them and ask the questions. There's also video libraries, you know, where you can go in, you know, just from how to, you know, things as basic as this is how you put on a uniform. And this is, you know, the order, this is how it's supposed to look, to like duty rigs and, you know, the difference of weapons and, you know, same thing with fire, you know, arson investigator, things like that, you know. And then on the publishing side, we have, you know, we have those, so the law enforcement and public safety subject matter experts. And then on the publishing side, we have a whole group of New York Times bestselling authors that are very successful self-publishers. And, you know, you can go in and ask them any questions that you might have. And there's a whole list of frequently asked questions and things like that. And everybody's very accessible. So that was our whole goal, is to just save everybody some time and have everything in one location. So,
tell people where that location is.
Oh, okay. It's at silverheartwriters.com.
Brilliant. And that's heart with an A,
H-A-R-T. Yes, H-A-R-T, Silverheart.
Yeah. Brilliant. And then I just wanted to ask you just one more question on the balance, because, you know, you've put on your blog and it's written there, you know, that you worked very hard. You had, you know, you got sick last year, that, you know, you this high volume production model, which has been popularized by romance writers mainly, and that many people feel has become this sort of burden. Is that the way it has to be? I mean, it seems like you've now found more of a balance, and, you know, you've got married and everything, so I hope you're managing your personal time, you know. So how can people balance that, running a business and, you know, real life?
No, I think you said the right word. It should not become a burden. You know, something that you love to do and that you're passionate about should never become a burden. And you know, it's, everybody's going to push it at different levels. You're going to be able to accomplish different things and have different goals. I'm always going to push hard and push fast, and because that's just the way I am. I don't know how to do it any other way. And and if I don't do it that way, then I start thinking of other things, like ideas and businesses and things like that. And so I just add to my plate. But I think my biggest thing was that I never took time outside of work or writing or traveling. You know, I had, you know, there were a couple years in a row when I had 50 flights a year, and I was speaking and I was signing and I was traveling everywhere, and I was still writing several books a year. And, you know, I'd have like 8 or 9 releases in a year. And, you know, your body can't sustain it. Your mind can't sustain it. And it's not healthy, but, you know, I almost got sick was a good thing. I should say it was not a good thing, but it was a good thing because I was forced to slow down and heal, you know. But, you know, just, you find out very quickly that it doesn't have to be done. You know, you're setting your own pace with this. You know, as long as you are continuing to write and continuing to put out, you know, quality content, you know, it doesn't have to be, you know, every week, every month, every 3 months, you know, every 4 months. You know, my goal, like my long-term goal, is to be able to get down to two books a year. And, you know, and I'm completely happy and satisfied with that. And I know that I can sustain. And I think that's why I pushed so hard, is because I knew I had to get to a point where I could sustain to be able to take some time off. When we'll add an extra couple days to each end of a trip, you know, that is a business trip, just to, and we might be working, you know, I might be writing, but, you know, we might be sitting out by a pool or, you know, whatever, enjoying ourselves and going to dinner or shows or whatever, you know, in the meantime. So it's not just all work and nothing else.
And so. we should also tell people about, you know, you have children too. Like so many people say, yes. Oh, you know, you must be just, you know, just a woman on your own, whatever, you know, but you've got kids, right?
Yeah, a bunch of them. Yeah.
So people can do this with children.
Oh, yeah. You know, I mean, when I started writing seriously, I had a 2 and a 3-year-old at home and, you know, and I was a band director. And I don't know if you guys have band directors there, but in the state of, you know, I was from Texas. In Texas, it's like being a football coach. I mean, you're working 80 hours a week. So I had 2 small children, and I was doing that. And I was writing during my conference period and lunch periods and, you know, passing periods. And I was getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to be at practice, you know, but I would still have my writing time, and I'd write when I got home. You do things that you find the time to do it if you want to do it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so, yeah, I mean, those 2 children somehow increased, and now we have a lot more children, but, you know, we have a lot of kids and they're all small. I mean, you know, the youngest is still 6 and they go up from there, you know, up to 23. So it's not like they're not involved in things, you know, they're not out of the house and gone. They're still, mm-hmm. you know, but figure out how to do it. If you know, you have to make family work, you have to make the business work and the career work, and you have to make your personal relationships work. So
brilliant.
It's not easy, but you can do it.
And you still love it, right? This is still what you love.
I do. Oh yeah, I can't imagine doing anything else, you know. I think that's why I have those 5 and 10 year and, you know, long term goals like that, because I have to see that, you know, that I can keep going and still, you know, sustain and things like that. And actually, like, one of the things that I've been doing a lot of research, you know, just statistical research for a lot of workshops that I do and stuff like that. I was going back through and I'm like, how amazing that we're in 2015. And since January of 2015, there's been an indie author on the New York Times list every week but 2.
Wow.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've seen the New York Times list shrink from 30 to 25 to 20, and now it's at 15.
Really? To try and push us all out.
Yeah. You know, and yeah, basically, you know, and so you see that and you know, and it's like all these stumbling blocks get in the way, and there's always going to be stumbling blocks. There's always going to be a KU. There's always going to be the New York Times list shrinking. There's always going to be a VAT tax. There's always going to be a royalty change, like at ACX. There's always going to be something. And the people that are successful at what they do in this business will look at that and then figure out a way around it. And they'll go, they'll figure out a way to where they're still making money and they still have a career and they're still producing books and they're still able to live off what they do. Those are not going to be the people that you're hearing, you know, the sky is falling and it's all over and I've got to jump in exclusive now, or I'm going to lose my whole career. Or, you know, you will never hear those people that are successful saying those things. They're going to keep their head down, and they're going to move around it.
Yeah. So, brilliant. So good to talk to you. You've been so inspiring as ever. Just tell people where they can find you and your books online.
Well, my books are everywhere at all the retailers, but you can check out my website at lilianahart.com.
Brilliant. Thanks so much for your time, Liliana. That was great.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.